Tonight, my guest is Dean W. Arnold. He is a journalist and publisher in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and the author of Old Money, New South, The Spirit of Chattanooga, America's Trail of Tears, A Story of Love and Betrayal, and the most recent, Hillary and Vince, A Story of Love, Death, and Cover-Up, which is the primary topic of our conversation tonight. He graduated from Covenant College on Lookout Mountain. That's not the one in Laurel Canyon, that's the one in Tennessee, with an emphasis in history and philosophy. Dean, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. If I had graduated from the one in Laurel Mountain, I'd know a lot more. Although I learned a lot from my alma mater. I'm not dissing it. It was a good college.
That's right. I remember Lookout Mountain. I remember that name from reading the, the Civil War history narrative. What's his name?
Shelby Foote.
Shelby Foote, yeah. Remember reading about Lookout Mountain.
That's a big, second biggest Civil War site here.
The War Between the States, the War of Northern Aggression, I prefer to call it. So.
Yeah, there you go. So, both of those. You hear those around here. Both of those a lot around here.
Yeah. There's also where the cracker line was, too, right? If I recall, was it Chattanooga that was laid siege by the Union Army? And
yeah, you mean where they went across the river and got the supplies going again?
Yeah, it was called the Cracker Line, right?
Yeah, that's a cool little story. And by the way, the interview you did with I think it was Ryan Dawson on the Civil War was really good. I enjoyed that one a lot.
Yeah, he's a great source for that stuff because he actually is from the South. He lives in Japan now. It was a good interview and kind of setting the record straight on that conflict.
Well, there's an old saying I heard a long time ago that there's nothing new going on in the world except for the history that you haven't learned yet.
That's definitely the case.
Yeah.
Give me revisionism. I want more. I lied to you about so much in history. Well, you've written this book, Hillary and Vince. Of course, this was, 23 years ago, coming up in 10 days, right? If I do my, 23, July 20th, 1993.
Yeah, very good.
So here we are, more than two decades after the fact. Why is this strange death still relevant today?
Well, the obvious one is that Hillary Clinton is about to become president of the United States, or possibly. And she certainly is deeply tied into whatever happened to Vince Foster. He was her close friend. Some say her best friend. They were lovers. And then he had this mysterious death. We don't know why he died. There's an immense amount of cover-up that she certainly played a part in. So you want to vet any presidential candidate. So that's the obvious reason. Secondly, I would say it's relevant because it provides a nice micro example of just how corrupt federal officials can be on the ground, at the very, primary level. So the people who saw Vince Foster's body, the people who first reported, the two or three FBI agents who pretty much handled the thing from soup to nuts, and a couple others. It doesn't take too many, and that's one of the reasons why these conspiracies can be pulled off. But they were highly corrupt, and I document in my book the lies, the falsifications, where they add things into the record whole cloth, where people and witnesses say things and they delete it from the record, where they plant evidence, falsify the gun. They wipe the gun clean from the prints. I mean, we go on and on and on in the book, but I think it's that's an interesting thing to learn on a micro level. You hear generalizations. The FBI is corrupt. Oh, the CIA is corrupt. Oh, the federal government. And people sort of hear that, but when you tell us a specific story, Vince Foster died, and the first witnesses on the scene saw no gun. The second witnesses on the scene saw a 9mm square large gun. And the third people on the scene, or the FBI said the official gun on the scene later, was a 38 caliber revolver, which was completely different from the other two. And so when you talk about that, now you got a specific story where you've got a real liar, and it kind of makes you raise your eyebrow. And so I think those specific stories are important. Now, one kind of interesting thing to note is that the main FBI agent on the scene for this incident, his name was Larry Monroe, was also the main spokesman for the FBI for the Oklahoma City bombing. So these characters keep cropping up again and again and again. And so it doesn't take too many of them. You know, you could have 5 or 10 of these guys who are just corrupt to the core and willing to lie and do whatever they need to do. And they're just kind of hands on these various things that come up, and a lot of deceit and a lot of injury and harm can be done to the American people. And I think, you know, this is what happens with these events now that we're dealing with, where, whether it's Orlando or Dallas or, you know, yada, yada, immediately the feds get jurisdiction. And so anything that the media reports to us, they just get it straight from the feds. And they're like little lapdogs. They'll just take whatever is handed to them and they just accept it and they don't investigate it. They don't even have the ability to investigate it. It's all, you know, sealed off and, you know, and no one can do anything. So this book is yet another example of how that happens. I think it's always good to be reminded of that.
That's an interesting point. This is the closed loop that's established. I think Patrick Henning sent 21st Century Wire gives a good rundown on how that's done. They immediately call it a terror event as opposed to like a local act of crime, which would mean the local authorities.
You got the coroner coming in and the medical examiner coming in, and you got the local police and the detectives and all these constitutional offices need to come in and actually deal with it. And these are people you know and trust, and these are people you've elected at office, and these are people that you can somewhat vouch for their credibility.
Yeah.
Now we just got a bunch of spooks in the Pentagon.
With no accountability to the public, really.
Right.
Essentially, yeah. And again, what happens with some of these events, and this again, it is the Foster case again is a good microcosm or an example of how these things can be controlled by relatively few people, because you're dealing with top-down, command control situations like the FBI, where people just follow orders and they're not going to buck the system because a lot can be done to them. Whistleblowers aren't treated very well in this country. It's very easy to control when if you have key people controlling the investigation, especially when you federalize it, which seems to be almost automatic these days without any regard for, for jurisdiction, states' rights, or federalism, anything. It's just automatic,
Yeah. The third answer for your question is why is this book relevant? A good part of the story, I trace the saga of the first witness on the scene. It probably was the first witness on the scene. It's disputable, but his name's Patrick Knowlton, and he came to the park. He needed to take a leak. And he gets out and he sees this very sinister man staring at him and kind of gave him this get the hell out of here look, or, something may happen to you. But he had to go so bad that he just kind of tentatively crept over to where he could do what he needed to do. Yeah, and he noticed, what kind of car was next to this guy, which was a light brown early 80s Honda. And that was about it. He was glad when he finally left that nothing had happened to him. And then he gets home and he hears that the Clinton's good friend, White House counsel Vince Foster, had been found that night dead in the park and by gunshot. And so he talks to his girlfriend about it. He wasn't even going to remember the whole incident until that happened, when he heard that on the evening news. He tells his girlfriend, he's like, well, she convinces him he needs to call the park police or tell somebody. So he makes a phone call that evening, and the official he talked to just didn't sound interested at all, and that was it. And the next morning, his conscience got to him. He says, I got to really talk to somebody who knows what's going on and tell him what I saw. And so he does that, and he talks to the detective who ended up being the main person in charge on the scene. And, he took his information, thanked him. It was all perfunctory and cordial. And that was it. 9 months later, the FBI did call him. He had an interview. By coincidence, quote unquote, his older Peugeot collector's automobile got its rear lights and its headlights smashed out by some weirdo with a crowbar. He didn't connect it to the FBI interview. But sure enough, after that FBI interview, no one contacted him again until they got a call from the London Daily Telegraph's Washington correspondent Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who said, "Hey, I've read your FBI interviews, and do you want to see him?" He's like, "Well, sure. I didn't know I could, you know, have access to him." Well, so he read them, and the FBI basically completely altered his testimony. They said he saw one kind of car when he testified to seeing a different kind of car. They said he couldn't pick out this sinister guy out of a lineup when he specifically said he could. He could definitely identify the guy. So Patrick Knowlton got very angry that his testimony had been altered. Then he was angry that, you know, the authorities who had been on this case for nearly a year, you know, didn't have any interest in his testimony that might overrule the idea that it was a suicide. And because of that London Telegraph interview, he finally got called by the grand jury the same day that article hit. And the grand jury was ignoring him. So the grand jury calls him to testify. And when that happens, like the day before, he and his girlfriend go on a walk, and 25, 30 different men start coming up and staring at him, walking by him, brushing by him, a couple in a car driving by slowly. It was a very strange thing that was a destabilizing maneuver. He had a couple reporter friends who, including Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who told him that it was an FBI surveillance net. And it was a known tactic that had been used during the civil rights movement and other places like that to destabilize a witness before he goes in and testifies. So this guy's getting harassed. He's getting his car bashed in. Pritchard ended up doing research on the guy who bashed in his car. The sheriff caught him. The guy had top secret access, higher than top secret. He was highly classified, and he contracted with the FBI. So that was clearly related to his earlier testimony. So anyway, this guy, Patrick Knowlton, he's just a regular guy, but all of a sudden he finds himself in this strange situation, and he finds the kind of the highest levels of the federal government are harassing him in a really terrible way. Well, one thing leads to another, and he hooks up with a friend of his who's an attorney. They met doing laundry because they were both bachelors, and this guy was a criminal attorney and kind of had some guts and was kind of good. And he ends up filing a lawsuit against the FBI, civil rights lawsuit. And so all of a sudden he's got the power of discovery. And so he and the attorney and another researcher named Hugh Turley, who got into the mix, they all sort of the trio of guys just started going after the Vince Foster case and trying to crack it. And so it's a very long saga. It's very interesting. They come up with a lot of good information. Long story short, their case goes to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court won't hear it. But they did file motion to have their 20-page report that basically contradicted all the facts that Ken Starr laid out in the Ken Starr report on the Vince Foster supposed suicide. They laid out all the facts that Ken Starr's report was basically erroneous and false. And the three-judge panel who appointed Starr approved tacking on Knowlton's appendix to the end of the Starr report. So the official record now, basically, if you read it, it's very compelling that Vince Foster was not a suicide. Starr was very upset about it. He personally wrote a 9-page letter pushing the judges not to allow Knowlton's report to be added to the to the official Starr report, but the judges overruled him. And so that's the permanent record. Now, that's kind of a long story, and there's a lot more to it. And the book's very interesting. I tell it in a, you know, kind of a interesting narrative. But the point there is that a citizen can make a difference. That's the third point of why this book is relevant, is that if, you know, just a regular person like you and me and others out there, you know, if we care about the truth and we want to spend some effort at it, you know, we can make a difference.
Now, with this case, there are some, I guess, particulars with the evidence that strongly indicate that he did not die in Fort Marcy Park. Vince Foster did not die in Fort Marcy Park. If I recall, the revision report had no mud on his shoes. They never found the slug that apparently, you know, apparently that killed him. You mentioned how the weapon changed three times.
Right.
The body, the way the body was laid out was sort of, I believe, recall it was kind of straight. In a way, you know, the way he would have, if he had shot himself, the body would have been, would have fallen differently. And didn't also, wasn't there also a witness that saw people running away from the scene?
Yeah, the first medic who came to the scene.
Yeah.
His name's Todd Hall, and he comes to the scene just as another guy gets there named Kevin Fornshill. Now, Fornshill was a park police officer who guarded the entrance to the CIA. And so he somehow, you know, serendipitously has the good fortune to be the first guy to show up and be at the body. And and so the medics are also responding to a 911 call, and they come over there. So this Todd Hall guy is the first guy to come over there. And as he's heading towards Fornshill, he sees some guy out in the woods and wearing some kind of orange vest running off. And he says to Fornshill, "Hey, there's a guy, there's somebody over there running away." And Fornshill just ignored him. So there was people observed running away from the corpse.
Hmm. That's odd that a security guard for the CIA would be. I'm familiar with the area. And Fort Mercy Park is, you know, 2-3 miles away from, you know, from Langley. Why would he happen to be at the park? Maybe, I don't know. Was that ever explained why he was, you know, that far away from, you know, the grounds of Langley?
I'd have to assume, and I don't know the answer to your question, but I'd have to assume that the CIA has another facility nearby.
Yeah, that could be the case. Also, they probably, this was 1993. This was almost seven months after they had that shooting incident at the front gate, and maybe they were enhancing. You know, they have a program where they drive around the area looking for things, maybe something like
right.
that. Yeah. So
yeah.
Maybe
that,
yeah.
Now, whether he was moved or not or was killed there, I haven't spent a lot of time on that. But let's talk about the bullet wound in the head, because that's pretty interesting. So the official record, the official report, you know, that claims suicide, and all the official reports said that he had a 1.25-inch hole in his head, which is a big hole. And so the official storyline is that he put the gun in his mouth, fired it, and it blew a big hole through his head. Well, the problem with that is that the 26 people on the scene, nobody saw a hole in the head. And several of them testify very adamantly that there was no hole in the head. The main detective gloved up and felt all over his head and found no hole. He said he found one mushy spot, but he didn't find any hole. And he was shocked when the coroner came back and said there was a 1.25-inch hole in his head. Now, several of the 26 people on the scene did see a small hole just below his jawline, which would make sense. Foster was tall. I think he was like 6'5". So it would make sense that someone smaller would, you know, get up against him and put a gun, you know, under his jaw and fire it, kill him. One of the medics who saw the hole described it as a low velocity, maybe like a 22 would have been fired there. And so the theory is that it went from the jawline through his head. And that's the mushy spot that the detective felt.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the gun that, was supposedly in his hand, if that gun had been fired in his mouth, you know, it definitely would have had a huge blowout hole coming out the other side. That's why they had to have a big old hole in the official record. Well, where did that come from? That hole only comes from one person. His name's Dr. James Beyer. And Dr. James Beyer, in his autopsy, said that there was a 1.25-inch hole in the back of Foster's head. Well, here's the problem. He marks in his x-ray, in his coroner's report, that he took x-rays. But then when people want to see the x-rays, he comes back around and he says, well, I actually didn't take any x-rays. So a few months later, the Senate Banking Committee has one day of hearings on Whitewater, and they spend a little time on Vince Foster's death. And and they bring up Beyer for some questioning. Most of the senators, you know, as those hearings typically go, it was kind of political and there wasn't much going on. But there was one senator who was really bird-dogging at Wells, Louch Faircloth from North Carolina. And so he brings up Dr. Beyer, Dr. James Beyer, and asks him, he says, okay, he says, you said in your report that you took x-rays, but then you say you didn't take x-rays. Did you or didn't you? And he says, well, I didn't take any x-rays. Well, he says, why'd you mark that you took x-rays if you didn't? He says, well, you know, I thought I was going to take x-rays, but we were having problems with our x-ray machine, so we ended up not taking x-rays. And he says, well, why didn't you bring in an x-ray machine from, you know, the nearby hospital or something? This is pretty big occasion here. What's going on? He says, well, we don't usually do x-rays, you know, autopsies, unless it's, you know, a gunshot wound or something. And, you know, it's just really bad answers. And then Faircloth says, he says, we have a report here where the park police said that you told them you took an x-ray, and you told them the results of the x-ray, that the x-ray showed no bullet fragments. He says, how can the park police report that when you didn't take an x-ray? And he says, well, I don't remember them telling me that. He says, well, they definitely do. It's on the record. He says, well, I have no explanation then. Well, that's, you know, that's just a really, really scary interchange. And but that's the only proof, alleged evidence that we have of this exit wound. Well, let's talk about Dr. James Beyer. He also had on his record, and this is stuff that Knowlton and his team dug up as they started doing research on this guy. He had another case in his background where a young man was found with a gun in his hand, and he ruled that he had shot himself in the mouth and had come out the head and the whole thing, and ruled it a suicide. Well, the parents didn't believe it, and he said that there was no sign of a fight or anything, so they called for exhumation of the body, which showed all these defense wounds on the guy. He had abrasions on his chest. He had cuts on the back of his hands, all this kind of stuff that's classic defensive wounds. And then it turns out that he was a DEI informant. It was just one bad thing after another. But his case got retried, and it was shown to be a murder. I forget who the murderer was. They found the murderer. I don't have that handy. Then there was another case where Beyer did the same thing. He declared a case to be a suicide, and the parents were upset again because they didn't believe it. But then the guy's girlfriend ended up confessing to the murder. So Beyer's got this long trail of declaring cases to be suicide that are actually murder. And it was this exchange that actually initially got me interested in this whole story. And I ended up writing the book 20 years later. But I saw this on TV when the hearings were going on. I actually taped it. I was incensed. I was furious. And I thought, well, surely this is going to be the big smoking gun, and it's all going to start coming out now. Well, you know, nothing happened. I took it to our local paper. We got one of the few conservative papers we did back then in Chattanooga, Christian guy, you know, Bible verses on the editorial page, all that kind of stuff, you know, right-wing Republican, all that. So I showed him this interchange with the coroner and how dirty it obviously was. And he kind of nodded and smiled, and that was it. And I just like, wow. And so it caused me to really start researching the whole thing and being very interested in it. But it wasn't until about 15 years later, 12 years later, that I found myself in the D.C., Baltimore area. I was living up there for a while, and I came across a friend who was a friend of Patrick Knowlton's sidekick, a guy named Hugh Turley. And I was like, you know, I'd like to meet those guys. You know, I've always been fascinated with their plight. And so I did. And I was in between gigs, and I needed to work on a good project. And so I spent several days with those guys. I learned all about their story. I got all their research and information. And so I decided to do a documentary on the whole Hillary and Vince story. And I wrote this treatment for the documentary, which ended up being this book. but I put 300 footnotes in there and everything. I wrote it like a book. I'm glad I did. But it was supposed to be a documentary, and that was in the fall, early fall of 2007, as Hillary is about to become the nominee for the Democrats. And just as I wrote the thing and I was about to go raise money for the documentary, she suddenly plummeted in the polls, and some unknown guy that no one had ever heard of named Barack Obama all of a sudden just rose to the top and was just like undoubtedly going to become the nominee. And once that was the case, I couldn't raise money for the documentary because it's like piling on. She's already out. So it just sat there for 8 years, and I had a friend about 3 months ago say, "You going to do something with that Hillary documentary?" And I was like, "Well, I don't know. It's been a long time." And I pulled out an old box out of the basement, dusted it off, and started reading the manuscript. And I was like, "Hey, this is good." And I read the next page, like, "Hey, this is really interesting." Now, yeah, this is. I hope I footnoted this. Oh yeah, there's some footnotes. Oh, good, good. And after I was done, I was like, "I think we could turn this into a book." You know, eight years ago, we didn't have print on demand, Amazon eBooks, and all that kind of thing, and so it's a lot easier to get something out now. So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's the history of that, of how the book came about.
Now, if I recall, after Vince Foster's body was discovered, there was a rush to seal his office and control files. It was done by, I think it was Bernie Nussbaum, and I forget the other lady involved in it. But it was clear that the White House was covering something up. And, of course, you also have the testimony of people saying that Hillary had been in his office several times the week before his death, and she claimed she hadn't seen him for 6 months or something. So you had that conflict. And this type of inconsistency would, I guess, mark Hillary Clinton as perhaps a suspect in his death, or at least being involved in it.
Yeah, connecting Hillary to the last days of Vince Foster is a little bit tricky. She did call him three times, or four times through her chief assistant Maggie. Is it Maggie Williams?
I think it was Maggie Williams. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's on the record. And, you know, she testified that she hadn't seen him at all a month before he killed himself. But another White House staffer testified under oath that she was there at least four times. But she was out of town a week before he died.
Mm-hmm.
She was the G7 in Japan, and then she was in Los Angeles, and then she was in Little Rock. And so she does have the alibi of not actually being there, although she was making phone calls to him via Maggie Williams.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a bit of a labyrinth. But you know, and we can get into all that.
Well, you know, these, if it were some type of high level assassination that was ordered, obviously she wouldn't be the trigger man.
Exactly.
It'd
right.
Be, you know, someone rid me of this meddlesome priest. You know, that's how it works at that level. And, you know, the word gets sent down. Of course, in your book, you detail that you seem to think that Hillary and Vince had a relationship, had an affair.
Right.
And so there's that. And I've heard, you know, I've heard that from other sources as well, that they were a couple for a while. And something happened where she... Because some people say that she dressed him down or something, or made him depressed, and that contributed to his death or something. I've heard that to his quote suicide. You know, that's one.
Yeah, and I've I looked at that here recently, the last few weeks. But then I've sort of been educated about that we need to stay away from that, because that's a couple of FBI officials who were associated with the case. One of them is kind of a known liar.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like it's just kind of potentially disinfo to make it look like a suicide, you know, that, you know,
yeah.
Hillary was mean to him and dressed him down, and that's why he killed himself. But Hillary, you know, they talk about these meetings, but she wasn't really in town the week before. So there's that. Here's the connection between Hillary and the murder. First of all, here's the main connection, in my opinion, is that she was very close to him. She was his lover. They were best friends, all this kind of thing. And then clearly his death was covered up. He was murdered, and it's just clearly a cover up. You can't deny it after you do some research or you read my book or whatever. And so the question is, why, if Hillary was so close to him, has she not tried to find out what happened to Vince Foster. Why hasn't she tried to get him justice? Why did she let her close friend and lover just get offed and allow this cover-up to take place? You know, and that's the real question. I think, you know, we can't really say she was the trigger person, like you say, and we don't even know that Vince Foster was killed because of something related to the Clintons. That, you know, it's likely, but he may have been involved in just some, you know, high level drug running or some, like, some really weird stuff that wasn't quite related to the Clintons, but it was so bad that he got killed for it. You know, why wouldn't Hillary try to look into it?
Yeah.
You know, that's really the question for me. And you know, that's the least harmful thing that you can say about Hillary in this situation, is that she didn't care that her best friend got killed and there was a huge cover up and she never did anything about it. That's the best. You know, the worst is that she was actually involved in the killing.
Now, you also, he apparently was at the White House that day, that afternoon, and left, but there's no record of him signing out.
Yeah. There's targeted questions by the senators to the two FBI agents about that, and they would not say how they know Foster left at 1:15, because they didn't check the logs of the Secret Service guys that track the cars coming in and out of the White House. The FBI interview where Foster's wife talks about how Foster supposedly drove his two children to the White House that morning, part of that's redacted. So if basically that interview implies or indicates that Foster did drive into the White House parking lot, then that would create a real problem as to why we don't have a record of him leaving the White House. So, you know, yeah, that's all part of it, too. Let's talk a little bit about why he got killed. Can I move it to that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. The motives. What if he was murdered, and there's a strong case to be made for that? Why?
Yeah, well, he talks about Nussbaum. Bernie Nussbaum was the chief White House counsel, and Vince Foster was deputy White House counsel. Well, they found in Nussbaum's safe a couple of manila envelopes sealed. One said Waco, and one said NSA. They were both put there by Foster's secretary. She testified that Foster had her put them into Nussbaum's safe. So in my book, the first theory I put out there, I don't think it's the best one, but it's just worth considering, is that he mentioned to several people that he was very concerned about Waco, and his wife said that it really tore him up to see those children die. Other people have run the phone logs of Hillary, Vince, and Hubble with Janet Reno, and said that it's pretty clear that they were all very much advising her, instructing her, and dealing with her throughout the whole thing, right up into the killing. And he was his secretary testified that he was working on a memo about Waco that morning. So that and the top secret folder that says Waco in the safe, and some other things like that, have caused some people to speculate that he knew some things about Waco and what really happened, and what the military did that was unconstitutional and very dangerous, and that there was some people high up in that apparatus that didn't want him squealing about that, and perhaps his conscience was getting to him about what, you know, the military had done in that situation. So that's the first theory. The second theory has to do with Foster's connections to Mena, Arkansas. Most of your listeners are probably familiar with this, but part of the Iran-Contra affair that's completely documented but was never talked about on mainstream media is that while, yes, the U.S. military was taking weapons down to Central America and helping out the Nicaraguan Contras in that way, they were coming back on the planes or whatever, they were bringing the weapons down there, and they're coming back with loads of cocaine, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of cocaine that were being sold in America, and the money used to finance the black operations. And Vince Foster was involved in that. And we know that for a number of reasons, but Ambrose Evans Pritchard in his book details it a good bit and talks with the wife of a security guard for the Clintons who was running drugs back and forth from Mina and running money. And she saw the money. She talked to her husband about the drug running in Mina. And he told her that Vince Foster was the one who was setting it up. And Foster was involved in a lot of clandestine stuff like this. He was the Clinton person for Whitewater and all those kind of papers and that sort of thing. But anyway, if he was involved in that kind of high level drug running for the U.S. government, that could be part of, you know, why, you know, what was he saying? What was he doing? What was he about to blow the whistle on? Perhaps, I don't know. But another interesting fact is that Ken Starr, who did the final investigation on the Foster case, and of course did work very hard to make sure that it wasn't actually, investigated. He actually has a background legally in, setting up the legal framework so that operations like MENA and Iran-Contra could take place. In 1982, he was the chief assistant to Attorney General William French Smith, who drafted basically, not legislation, but basically an agreement, a framework between with the CIA. At that time, the director was William Casey, and I've got letters going back and forth between those two, where they basically set up a situation where intelligence officers, CIA, no longer had to report illicit drug activity that they had seen or were aware of. Before that, there was an obligation to report such things, but now in 82, that was taken away, which allowed them to just roll up their sleeves and get involved in something as terrible as MENA and not be held legally liable for it.
That's interesting. Ken Starr's involvement in that, because he was somehow involved in the facilitation and importation of illegal drugs into the country to fund this deep state operation, which anyone who's familiar with the CIA and clandestine services and its predecessor, the OSS, knows that's been going on for a very long time. But Ken Starr is a nephew of Cornelis Vanderstar, who was also known as C.V. Starr, who passed away in 1968, but he was an American businessman, he's also an OSS agent, and also founded the American International Group, AIG. His Star company became AIG, and that was kind of known, that's kind of known as the CIA's insurance company.
Amazing.
So these connections, it's kind of funny why he would be in, you know, he would replace Fisk and just produce this limited hangout, the Star Report, which would, you know, which would whitewash the Vince Foster death and also not look too far deeply into MENA, but focus on this Lewinsky scandal, which was salacious and got a lot of attention, but diverted attention away from a lot of other worse things that were going on during the Clinton administration and before, by the way, which might explain the cover-up, because MENA connects the Clintons to Iran-Contra, Oliver North, the Reagan-Bush administration. So you see the bipartisan nature of these scandals.
Right.
You know, people don't know that the Bushes and Clintons are partners.
Yeah, was it Terry Reid, or I think it was Terry Reid who testifies that he was at a meeting at MENA that I think was attended by George H.W. and Bill Clinton and Ollie North. I think they're all kind of like in a bunker or something.
Yeah. And because he was one of these, I guess, these, you know, piss and vinegar patriotic people doing intelligence work until he saw what was really going on. You know, a lot of these people who do this stuff are true believers. They're fighting the good cause, and they don't realize they're just pawns in this, you know, this game of, you know, elitist, you know, New World Order CFR game of drugs, you know, fomenting revolution, wars abroad, and just making the world a hellhole so they can profit off all the suffering. So
yeah, you know, it's always hard to tell what little factoid is going to kind of push you over the edge or kind of get you to the next level. And one of the ones for me was I can't remember where I read it, or maybe I heard it on one of your interviews or something, but Skull and Bones way back when was involved in the opium trade in China.
Oh, yeah, that goes back to the 1830s. That goes back to the establishment of the American elite.
You know, that was just one of those factoids that for me is like, wow, this has been going on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I want to also mention real quickly, because this is really important part of the book and important for people to hear, and that's the story of the main prosecutor for Ken Starr in their Foster investigation. His name was Miguel Rodriguez, and he was immediately hired when Ken Starr was appointed to investigate the Foster death. They found him in Sacramento. He had been involved in prosecuting gangsters and, you know, the mob and that sort of thing. And he was younger, Hispanic, obviously, and was kind of a left winger, wore a leather jacket on the weekends with an earring. And, you know, there was rumors that he was maybe a little soft, maybe even gay. But he was the kind of person that, you know, they like to appoint for these sort of things because maybe blackmailable, whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts looking into the case, but he starts doing a really good job, and he starts calling witnesses to the grand jury, and he starts uncovering this stuff, and he realizes that this thing's a murder. It's not a suicide, and he starts moving forward on it very, very swiftly. Well, he wrote a 30-page memo listing all the evidence and all the stuff we've talked about today. It's all basically in this 30-page memo. And he sends it to Starr. And basically, Ken Starr is like a judge, and he's like a chairman of a board way off somewhere, you know, off, not hands-on. And so he's got like a staff of 200. So he's not really hands on this stuff, but he's got a number two man, a number three man, you know, who are kind of more hands on the situation. Well, when they find out that Rodriguez is really starting to crack the case, they freak out and they start confronting him. They start threatening him. They start throwing chairs around in his office. And one of the guys, the number two guy in the Starr investigation, was a guy named Mark Toohey. It's spelled T-U-O-H-E-Y. He was a big Democrat, and he was absolutely terrorizing Rodriguez and telling him he could not proceed further. And and Toohey wasn't just any old Democrat. He was married to Richard Daley's sister. And Richard J. Daley, the father, that was her father. Of course, his brother-in-law, Richard Daley, ended up becoming Obama's chief of staff in 2011. So this guy, very, very big Democrat. And so he absolutely just would not let Rodriguez proceed. And he started threatening him and this, that, and the other. And then he stopped the grand jury investigations. He wouldn't let Rodriguez call anybody else to the grand jury. And so in January of 95, Rodriguez resigned. In his resignation letter, he just basically said, I can't continue because I don't have the ability to crack the case. And so that's the story of Miguel Rodriguez. So the lead prosecutor, who wrote a 30-page memo outlining all the evidence, had to resign because he wouldn't come up with the answer that they were looking for.
Mm-hmm. That's how you squelch an investigation, and if no one backing you up, then you can do nothing about it. If Starr is not going to, you know, discipline these people and let this go on, just, you know, obviously you can stop an investigation. Of course, you mentioned with a staff of 200, I'm sure there's plenty of room in there for that staff to be infiltrated. I mean, if Garrison, who investigated the Kennedy assassination, had his staff infiltrated, and it turns out he did. I'm sure this staff is peppered with all types of informants and agents and mucking up the works, you know.
Yeah. Now, so here's more of a speculation thing, but just to try to figure out how bad this thing was that would cause such high levels. I mean, this is a murder that has been covered up from the highest levels. Why is it that big a deal? What is going on here? And I don't know that we really figured out what exactly it was. that caused Vince Foster to be killed. Now, something very interesting that was found in the National Archives, Patrick Knowlton and Hugh Turley, on a regular basis, about every 6 months, they go down to the National Archives and they wade through thousands of documents and find stuff about the Vince Foster case. They've been doing it for 20 years. That's how we have this 30-page memo from Miguel Rodriguez. They found it in the National Archives about 10 years ago. But one of the things they found one day, which is the oddest thing, is they found this this report, cover to a report that that says child abduction. Report on child abduction related to the Vince Foster case. Now, they're pretty sure that it got put in there by mistake. It looks to be the cover of a full report. The report wasn't put in there, just this cover. And so their sense is that it was stuck in there by mistake. Ken Starr has represented Epstein in the past, so you got that little question. But we don't know what that's about. But I think it's an interesting little factoid because it does answer, you know, how bad could it get that would cause someone as kind of, you know, Vince Foster was no, you know, he was no princess. He was a pretty dirty guy. He was involved in a lot of crappy Clinton dirt. So if he was killed because he was about to blow the whistle, it must have been something really bad.
Well, yeah, you mentioned the Epstein connection. That's he's representing Ken the Star, representing Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted pedophile, billionaire pedophile, who got off on, you know, with a slap on the wrist with that plea deal with the Bush administration, by the way. That ties in Clinton because Clinton's been connected to Epstein riding on his plane, the Lolita Express. And oddly enough, also Trump is connected to it.
He sure is.
So this might be why this is one of the scandals that Trump doesn't mention on the campaign trail, but also why the Republicans stay away from it. This is how these things work, is they implicate both sides, and that's kind of how the system is controlled. But with Epstein, there's much evidence to suggest that is some sort of intelligence operation. And those who are in the know, or at least familiar with how these things go, is that, you know, sexual entrapment, honey traps, these things are ways that the intelligence agencies control the political process, how they neuter oversight. They compromise politicians and officials and, you know, corporate leaders, these sort of things. So this is why the intelligence agencies are often involved not only in drug trafficking, but in human trafficking.
Yeah, let me read the cover of this title. I just emailed it to you while we're talking, but it's called Questions for a Suicide Expert, Vincent Foster Death Investigation, and the title on the top says Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit.
Well, are you familiar with some of the research? Dave McGowan, of course, investigated the phenomenon of the serial killer, and he seemed to think it was tied to military intelligence, going back to the Phoenix sort of a domestic application of the Phoenix operation.
Yeah,
and that this some of these serial killers are sort of it's an adaptation or sort of variation of Murder Incorporated, where you can have someone pose as a serial killer, actually be a serial killer, but interspersed within those killings are targeted individuals. It's a way you can murder somebody and have it blend into the background, so to speak. I think the case of Henry Lucas in Texas, where he was he claimed to have killed thousands of people, was, I think, found guilty for dozens, but directly tied to hundreds. And he took the authorities on a grand tour of the burial sites of his victims. But he was, you know, convicted serial killer in Texas, and he's the only person on death row to receive a commutation from George W. Bush, which is an odd choice for a commutation. His partner in crime, Otis Toole, who was believed to be involved in the Adam Walsh killing. I don't know if you remember that back in 1980. It was one of these early national incidents where a child was abducted and murdered. And he since confessed to the murder of Adam Walsh. And he was He was a kind of a Henry Lucas's partner, and that killing had some sort of had satanic elements to it, decapitation, things like that. These things are thought to be one thing. It can be a murder incorporated thing. It also could be a strategy of tension.
Yeah, kind of like the mass shootings now.
Mass shootings, yeah.
Yeah, McGowan kind of argued that the serial killers, the phenomenon, which interestingly, it kind of ended, kind of like the moon, moon landing suddenly,
and the
serial killers kind of sort of stopped.
Yeah,
and now we're into mass shootings on a regular basis.
And again, one thing is he ties into many of these serial killers have ties to the government. They get special treatment. There's inexplicable police incompetence to explain why they get away. But that's going down the rabbit hole. This is what you're saying. This is another explanation of why these cases why is it being squelched? Why is it being shut down? Because it's opening up a can of worms. Good example of that is also the Franklin case, where this guy, Larry King, who operated the Franklin's credit union in Idaho,
Nebraska, wasn't
Nebraska,
it?
Nebraska, sorry, yeah, Nebraska, yeah. Nebraska was he had people go get kids from the Boys Town home over there, and they would, these children or younger, you know, they were maybe tweens or teenagers, early teens, they would be kidnapped and they'd be sent around the country to service politicians and corporate leaders. And this goes back to the Blackmore operation, because one of the places they went was to a mansion in Washington, D.C., run by a GOP lobbyist named Craig Spence, who was a noted homosexual. And he eventually committed suicide when the investigation got hot. And the Washington Times did a story on this, the call boy ring being run through the White House. And it's supposed to be serious, and it got shut down. I think Paul Rodriguez was writing that story for the Washington Times. But what it does was, this was a blackmail operation being operated out of D.C. And this is another way that you control politicians. But another thing is, you know, he ran a credit.
Remember that page boy scandal? About 15 years ago in Congress. You heard about it for about 2 or 3 days.
Yes.
It was all documented. It was all real. But for some reason, it just completely went away.
Goes away, yeah. These things just go away. And, well, another interesting dimension to the Franklin scandal was that, of course, the bank that he ran, apparently $40 million went missing. This was a very large sum of money for a small operation. This gets into the savings and loans and how they were utilized by the mob and the intelligence agencies. They were raided to pay for black operations and criminal operations, drug running. And it's almost like many of these savings loans, they went up. There are miniature BCCIs all over the country. And this involves the Bush administration, the first George W. H.W. Bush administration, who orchestrated the bailout then. And, of course, it was George Bush's son, Anil Bush, who ran the Silverado savings and loan, went belly up. And, you know, a bunch of bad sweetheart loans to people. And if you get into, I think it's Peter Bruton's book, CIA, the Mafia, and George Bush, gets into how these banks are being utilized by organized crime and intelligence operations to fund criminal operations, drug running, and black ops, because they're all in bed together. And this branches out into like owners of sports franchises and corporate leaders and all that stuff. And again, this explains why no one can afford to really look into these things, because if you really do an honest investigation, you undercover all sorts of crimes being involved, whether it's human trafficking, drug running, financial fraud, you know, and it's all related. So,
yeah, I guess that makes sense. And that high level of evil is hard for most of us to comprehend. But back to my original point, when that is that if something related to what this document says, child abduction and serial killer unit, if that is related to the Foster death, Foster murder, that would make some sense. You know, financial fraud, I don't think someone's going to necessarily get killed for that. Maybe they would be. Or I don't think someone's going to speak out about that. Let's put it that way. But would they speak out about human trafficking and child abduction? Well, they might.
Well, are you familiar with the FBI agent Gunderson?
No.
He did an investigation on the McMartin child abuse scandal in California, and he was a former FBI agent. Now there's some people question his
Oh, the Gunderson guy who gave the lectures and all this stuff. Yeah, I've seen that once or twice.
And he one of the things he investigated was the Finders case. And the Finders case was that there's a kind of this cult that was discovered down in Florida. They were trafficking in these young kids. Their kids were found in a van down, I think it was in Florida, if my memory serves me correct. And of course, local authorities investigated. So this is why we know what went on, because local authorities initially investigated this and did their job. They traced it all the way up in the DC into a warehouse in DC where they had like international. This is the late 80s or early 90s, so they were like international fax machines and connections and all that. There were these, and these kids were being marketed globally. The authorities were investigating, and the investigation was shut down by the Justice Department by the request of the CIA as a national security concern.
Yeah.
So that gives you some, may give you some hint of what was going on there.
Right.
You know, it goes back to what, again, this is one of these things where it's all part of the drug running, the arms, the illegal arms deals, the civil wars, and the human trafficking. It's all related. So the moment you investigate, the moment you start pulling on a thread, it starts to come undone, and someone has to stop it. And if that involves shooting a deputy counsel, at the White House, that might be a, an action that someone's willing to do to just snuff it out, stop it,
Right.
send a message or something.
Right.
It's speculation, but I think it's warranted speculation. So.
Well, a couple other things I wanted to mention to you that you might find interesting. Do you know who the one of the main witnesses was in the White House counsel's office that gives us a lot of the information of what happened the day of Foster's death? And was also the person who told us that Kathleen Willie got sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton.
Linda Tripp.
Linda Tripp. She's in three places. She's in the White House counsel's office the day of Vince Scott Foster's death as a secretary. Then she's working in the White House when Kathleen Willie gets sexually assaulted. And she's the reason we know about it, because she told the press. And then she moves to the Pentagon and finds herself right next to a, wouldn't you know it, a girl named Monica Lewinsky. So she's a real interesting character. To me, there's a possibility that she's kind of working for somebody besides just a gal trying to make a living.
Well, that Lewinsky thing, I think you could make the case that that is a diversion that was created by at some level to get away from the larger scandals like MENA Arkansas and the Arkansas Development Finance Agency, which was involved in laundering much of the drug funds coming into Arkansas. And this is where the Arkansas officials got to wet their beaks a little bit. That's how you got them into the action. Monica Lewinsky. I was, there's a interesting intelligence operation that's run by the Israeli government. It's called Helpers or SANMs, and apparently they claim, at least there was Victor Ostrovsky, who wrote the book "Other Side of Deception." He claims that there are roughly 1 million of these helpers around the world, a part of the diaspora that do an intel support, financial support. They work within agencies, corporations, wherever, to support, Israeli foreign policy objectives or intelligence operations. And there are some su evidence that suggests that Rahm Emanuel, who is also is Jewish and also was a member of the Israeli Defense Force, although I suspect he's probably an intelligence operative like his father, put Lewinsky in the White House. And what the suggestion here is that when you put someone like Lewinsky in the White House near someone like Bill Clinton, the Mossad would have a personality profile on Bill Clinton, and it's very easy to predict what was going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
And apparently there was a report that when Clinton met Netanyahu in Rye River in like 1998, 1999, that he said to Clinton that we had tapes of you talking to Lewinsky on the phone. But don't worry, we got rid of it. which, you know, that's an obvious threat.
Right, right.
J. Edgar Hoover used to issue the same threats to people in Washington, D.C. You know, don't worry, it's secure with us, so don't worry, we'll never blackmail you. Wink, wink, nod, nod.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that there's evidence to suggest that perhaps Linsky was set on Clinton to compromise him. And at some level, when the scandal broke, maybe someone saw the opportunity to divert it to this salacious sex scandal and get the Whitewater investigation away from where the real sexy stuff was, which is drug running and murder in Arkansas.
Yeah, you know, one of the lines that caused me to give more entertainment to your theory there. I sort of believe your theory, but if you remember at kind of the very end of the whole narrative, they interview Monica Lewinsky and, you know, and then the very last thing she says, on one more thing, I hate Linda Tripp. And that sounded so canned and scripted to me. And I just thought, you know, that's really weird, but they really want to kind of really make sure that everybody knows that they hate each other and that this was all just, you know, came out because of that. But it really, I think there's a real strong evidence for collusion.
What's odd there is that the whole story behind her going to the Pentagon was the White House wanted to get her away from Bill Clinton and over at the Pentagon. And they sit her right next to Linda Tripp, who's already testified in these cases. I mean, that's...
Right, right.
I mean, I remember hearing about that and kind of laughing about it. I'm thinking, oh, those idiots, you know. But again, Bill Clinton isn't making that decision. Someone else is making that decision. Well, and whoever's making that decision could also be an asset who's working to either undermine Clinton at one level, but at the same time, save him because he's involved in so many horrible things, other things, that if you get the country talking about the sex scandal, they know the pulse. They can take the pulse of the country. This will turn into a salacious sex scandal where, you know, trivial matters which will dominate the public's attention.
Right.
At the same time, they get to drag, they get to lower the country's morality a little lower because we hear about, you know, cigars and things like that, right? And that's
right, right.
So they get
right.
To do that. And
Linda Tripp, I read an article where she's now she's working at some like gift shop or something, but she's had plastic surgery, so she's changed her persona.
Yeah, and so, but she apparently didn't she have connections to military intelligence or Delta Force or something?
Yeah, Delta Force. Yeah, that's what I'd read. That's where her roots came from. So, yeah, all that is an interesting thing. So I just wanted to bring up the Linda Tripp thing. That's kind of interesting.
Well, another thing, because you got to consider these things. Nothing is as it seems. We have to consider this. Especially
also, another part of the story that you might want to have me mention is that, you know, so there was question early on if Miguel Rodriguez was gay, and that was one of the reasons he got chosen because he'd been easily blackmailable. Well, just a couple years after he resigned and moved on from all this, he had a sex change operation. And he's now Michelle Rodriguez.
Hmm. Okay. Confirmed. No, but
yeah. And so, okay. Interesting character. But I actually called him her about 2 weeks ago and tracked her down. She's still a prosecutor on the West Coast. I won't give too much information, but hard to find.
Yeah.
But I was able to find her and called her up, and we chatted briefly. She was polite. She said she couldn't give me any information. She couldn't confirm or deny anything that I'd written. And I said, okay. So we just talked a little bit, and that was it.
Yeah, I was reading this about the Star Report, and there's the graphic nature of it. So I read this article. So the Star Report, however, went far beyond establishing that the president lied when he denied having sexual relations with Lewinsky and included sexual details of various encounters that suggest the report also had its purpose to embarrass Clinton and thus limit his effectiveness as president. Okay, that's his interpretation. But it was Judge Richard Posner who wrote the book An Affair of State, The Investigation, Impeachment, and Trial of President Clinton. He said, the details are a distraction to anyone who wants to understand and evaluate Clinton's presidency or the role, the function of the president in the American government society. And he tended to write it off as somehow this is because of Starr's animus towards the president, because Starr was, you know, Clinton's team had run Starr's name through the mud in the media. But I'm what I'm suggesting, what I think the possibility is, all this was a choreographed play for us to distract attention away from what was really going on, which was MENA, Arkansas, and that just doesn't involve the Clintons. It involves the Bushes, the CIA, and the deep state.
There's also China Gate and yes. And Ron Brown. Those need to be distracted from as well.
Exactly. But again, it's one of these things where the country was fixated on this thing for a year, 2 years. He was impeached for it and acquitted in the Senate. But it was one big distraction away from some of these other things, which I think threatened a lot of bigger people than the Clintons. But you're familiar with the movie Wag the Dog?
Oh yeah.
Now one of the big keys tip offs to me that the Monica Lewinsky thing was choreographed was the fact that they have a scandal in that movie that mimics the Lewinsky scandal to a T, even to the photograph where he's hugging a girl in a beret.
Oh.
And the movie was released in the fall of 1997, and the Lewinsky scandal broke in January 1998.
Oh.
So whoever wrote that, whoever produced the movie, now making a movie about a president being embroiled in a sex scandal in the mid-90s wasn't – you don't have to be a soothsayer to know that, because, with Clinton and all – Clinton was elected as a known philanderer. But to get it to such detail suggests to me that the whole thing, not just the scandal itself, but how it would be played out in the press, the pictures that would be leaked. I mean, it really suggests like the whole thing was choreographed.
I don't have a problem with that. And I totally agree with you. That was a huge distraction, distraction from what? Is it MENA? Is it China Gate? Is it both?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the Vince Foster killing? Is it the Ron Brown killing? Is it both? I don't know. But diversion is a pretty, pretty common thing that's done.
And this is how big MENA was. I got this off of Mike Rivera's website. What really happened?
Right. Oh yeah.
And he writes this about MENA. He says the area of the website has been assembled in response to the persistent claims a few individuals that MENA is a myth, that the CIA never ran cocaine through MENA airport or laundered the proceeds through various Arkansas financial institutions, including Morgan Guarantee, Madison Savings and Loan, Worth and Bank, and most importantly, the Arkansas Development Finance Authority. That such activities took place at MENA, among other locations, should hardly be surprising. As read through most newspapers, shows that government connections to drug running are not only commonplace, they have become the inevitable symptom of a totally corrupt of our totally corrupted times. And I think that explains, could be a possible explanation why Vince Foster was murdered. Because this would, although he may be blowing the whistle on something that may first appear to be totally unrelated, it is all related. Because you have all these financial connections and governmental connections. At each stage of the game, whether it's a DEA, the FBI, or the Pentagon, they're all elements within these agencies or departments that are compromised, that are involved in this criminal activity, and it's called foreign policy. So,
have you heard the theory from James Norman?
Not offhand. What is that one?
He was a editor for Forbes magazine,
mm-hmm.
And he had a big investigation. Where he came up with they were sources off the record, unfortunately, but they were like intelligence forces, CIA, that sort of thing. And he said that Foster, from the very beginning, was involved in crafting the software that Israelis and others used, financial software that had a back end kind of.
Is this Inslaw?
Yeah, I think it was called Inslaw first, and then it was called Promise.
Yeah, the Promise software. Yeah. Prosecutors, research.
Yeah, so Vince Foster was involved in that way back when in Arkansas. And so basically the theory is that, there's several maybe hubs, for this spy software. And one of them was in Little Rock, and Vince Foster was very involved with it. So, you know, he suddenly gets graduated up to White House deputy counsel. So that's like a coup for the gangsters, the and the spies and everybody else that are involved in this thing. So, yeah. They, you know, so now he's at a much higher level. So Norman's writings, Forbes wouldn't let him publish his article and his theories. He ended up printing it in a publication called Media Bypass. But he basically said that there was a kind of a wing, a group within the CIA that were disgusted by all the payoffs that were going on.
Uh-huh.
And they were, I may not be remembering this exactly correctly, but they were basically leaving some kind of message with various members of Congress and telling them they need to resign or they were going to expose them. And so all these members of Congress were suddenly resigning about this time. And he had all this, another group called the Angel of Death. It started to sound a little weird at some point, but anyway, he connected all this stuff together to Vince Foster and his connection with this stuff, and that Israeli espionage was a key player in it.
Well, that's not, I mean, again, if you follow the Promise software and what Danny Casolaro, the reporter who was committed suicide supposedly in West Virginia in a hotel, he uncovered what he called the Octopus, and it had to do with this Promise software. And I don't know whose feet he was stepping on. It could have been anybody. When you get into this, you know, level of intrigue and criminal activity, it could have been anyone who decided to kill him. But, you know, he's not the only reporter to, you know, commit suicide investigating, you know, these things. You have Gary Webb and how he met his demise, shot himself twice in the head after he exposed the crack cocaine connection to Iran-Contra and of course, MENA, Arkansas, where the cocaine was coming through. These things do branch out. The financial angle is particularly interesting because that's where you get in this high level, you know, malfeasance and fraud that's going on. Some people who are looking at the 9/11 also have looked into AIG's involvement in that firm Marsh McLennan, regarding, software and it being involved in, you know, vast financial fraud.
I didn't find Norman's theory. I'll send you the article on it, mm-hmm. but I found it interesting. But everybody was off the record. It was all anonymous. And then the story just kind of sounded kind of weird when he started getting into the Angel of Death, which was this another small group that was, you know, it was the some more sophisticated version of putting a banana peel on someone's door knob.
Okay.
So it didn't quite ring true to me, but what it did ring true on was it was something big enough to make sense that someone like Vince Foster gets offed. You know, if Israeli espionage is part of the equation, you know, that could be pretty bad.
Yeah, yeah. Now, bring it up to the present now. Of course, we have Hillary Clinton, who's a presumptive Democratic nominee for the president, and she apparently has been cleared by the FBI. They recommend no prosecution for email scandal. And again, this another thing where you have a situation where it's an odd scandal because I don't quite understand how secure emails could be so easily transferred over to a non-secure site. But nevertheless, apparently it did happen. But this involves, you know, the Clinton Foundation, which some people have said is just a foreign money laundering operation disguised as a charitable organization. And this might explain why she erased those 30,000 emails, because she was using her office to more or less sell favors to foreign entities.
Yeah, I don't understand it too well, but something to the effect of, put $10 million in the Clinton Foundation and we'll put $1 billion worth of weapons in your military.
Yeah, well, basically it works something like, you know, you would the way the charity would operate, it was kind of like used to conceal cash. What happened was the donors would give to a charity. The charity would then bundle it and give it to the Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, some guy out of Canada was one of the key guys doing
that. And so it's the and because perhaps the emails detailed these transactions, but you know, a lot of, basically what it's the same old story of the Clintons using their public office to, for their own personal enrichment and peddling their influence. But with another interesting story angle to this is it's at least from my from my standpoint of electoral politics, it shows just such a tremendous poor judgment on her part, because all those emails that were on a non-secure server, one would have to assume that server was hacked by foreign intelligence. And now these foreign intelligence agencies would have the goods on the President of the United States, which probably isn't a new thing, but, you know, so where do you go with that?
Yeah, I was talking to someone yesterday that, or earlier today, that Guccifer, who said he easily got into Hillary's emails, that he was found dead in prison a couple days ago. Virginia prison.
Really?
Yeah.
So no, add another one on the body count?
Yeah. And you know, it. I saw where he died, but it's not hit the mainstream media at all. So no one really knows about it. Sometimes because my Twitter feed has people like you on it, you know, I sometimes wonder when I see a news story if I'm the only one who knows about it, or if the whole world knows about it. You know, it's kind of, you're not sure anymore.
Yeah. And oh, you remember back during the Lewinsky thing, you had those interns that ended up dead with the name M or something, Mahoney, and
yeah, who was
Starbucks?
Who was talking about that? Was that Michael Jones was telling you that story?
It wasn't Michael Jones. No, I just remember the
that was one of your interviews, I thought, but
it was like there was supposedly a robbery where no cash was taken, and the story is one guy was convicted for it. He claimed that he demanded them to open the safe, and she refused to open the safe for him, which I thought was odd. I mean, who's it's like I'd die for Starbucks? I mean, okay, that's the claim. But she had been a witness to much of the interns being harassed by Bill Clinton, and she was going to be targeted, I guess, to give a statement or go under oath. And she ends up being shot to death at Starbucks with two other people.
Yeah, actually, I heard this from Mike Rivero on a Ed Opperman podcast.
Okay.
Yeah, Rivero said that what happened was that some information got leaked that there was about to be a big scandal revelation that was going to come out from a intern with the initial M. And so a week before or a couple weeks before the Monica thing blew up, two or three different interns in Washington that had the initial M were like suddenly strangely killed. One of them was it Mary Mahoney? Was that her name? At a Starbucks, and a couple others like that. So that was a very strange story. The other one that I think was pretty clearly sex espionage was that who was the guy that the congressman who
Gary Condit?
Yeah, had the chick, and 9/11 kind of caused everybody to quit thinking about him, but he had that Jewish gal that suddenly disappeared, and he was they never talked about this when they talked about it 24/7 on the news, but he was a member of the intelligence committee.
Yes, and, this is again another good that saying them these intelligence operatives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he, you know, Gary Condit very much, you know, he must have taken some position that somebody didn't like. And next thing you know,
it was
some girl.
Chandra Levy. Yeah.
Yeah. Next thing you know, some girl he's messing with disappears.
And I heard that she also understood she was on she was also came from the Federal Board of Prisons. And she was involved in somehow connected to Oklahoma City. With Timothy McVeigh's trial, that might have been just a coincidence.
Really?
There's some connection to the Oklahoma City thing, too.
There's no coincidence there. I'd like to know who that is.
Chandra Levy, I did an interview about Oklahoma City. I think that came up in that interview. I have to get the details on that again. But that's another odd connection there. Because that was the summer of 2000. Was it the summer of 2000 or 2001 when that happened?
Well, it would be 2001 because it was the big top news story until 9/11.
Yeah, because she apparently had something to do with how Timothy McVeigh's so-called alleged execution. and she was involved as, I think, an intern or an employee at the Bureau of Prisons. I think I might have the detail wrong on that. Somehow involved in his execution, which some people have questioned. Because
right.
he apparently was an intelligence operative that was sheep dipped, and you know, they can fake anything,
right?
And they didn't have an autopsy, and he was cremated without his family's permission. So there you go,
right?
You know,
yeah. Back if we'd have had IMBD back then, they might have both been actors on IMDb. Who knows?
Wait, I heard a headline today that Bin Laden's son is vowing to seek revenge for his father's death.
Yeah, boy, I saw that too, man. I thought, man, that, you know, if, you know, I write movie scripts. I've written a few, and my book is written in narrative form. And so as a movie script writer, when I saw that headline, I was like, yeah, that's good. Those guys, they're doing real good when they're coming up with the next storyline. That really makes sense. You got to have someone with a good, strong motive, you know, and someone that, you know, ties into previous work, and you don't want to just give up all that work, you know, because Bin Laden was a really good boogeyman for them. So, yeah, bring up the son.
Well, the headline should read, "Son of former CIA asset vows revenge."
There you go. Alleged son.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to see that they have some, like, weird picture, you know, where he's, you know, on a beach somewhere, and I guess you know nothing will add up, but, you know, the angle will be off or something. And
yeah, well, this is not quite related, but it is, but I'm thinking about doing some podcasting myself, and one of the questions I want to start asking various people like yourself, interview them, and that is really two main questions. One is, where do you get your good sources? I mean, you just can't watch mainstream TV or mainstream sources anymore. You just can't trust them. I mean, you can look at them, but it's got to come from somewhere else. And so what are they, and how do you find them? That's one question. And then the second question I have is, when you're, you know, doing alternative media research and trying to figure out what's going on, like we're doing, you know, what is the ultimate purpose? You know, and it's a philosophical question.
Yeah.
that you know, I think probably comes down in large part to your calling. You know where God places you in this puzzle, but you know, it's a difficult question to answer. You know, it's kind of like the old question, why do you heal people? Why do you pray for someone to be healed if we're all going to die anyway? I mean, there's an answer. There's a theological answer there, and there's a good answer, but it's not easily answered.
Yeah, for me, it's a form of therapy, maybe a little bit of vanity. But, you know, you take in someone's information over the years, you got to start, you know, I guess, spewing it out again. With your own interpretation. I mean, it
certainly can't be just therapy. I mean, you've got to have a belief that what you're doing is somehow going to contribute to making things better.
Yeah, well, the first thing in solving the problems is trying to figure out what's going on and talking to, you know, you spend so much time reading people's work and, you know, the better part of, you know, 15 years. And then you realize that you get over the technologically hurdles, which are fairly easy if you run a simple show, which I do technically from a technical standpoint. And after so many years of doing research, this stuff sort of just accumulates in your brain, and you're able to kind of see the bigger picture and understand things. This is why I have to have some sympathy for people who don't understand these things. They haven't either found the time or taken the time to look into these things, because it's very hard to connect the dots and understand the bigger picture if all you do is relying on mainstream media or academia, you know, establishment sources for the information, which are designed to deceive you and misinform you, get you asking all the wrong questions. And I ran into that too, because you realize when you come across talking to people who really don't look into these things, they really have a fundamental misunderstanding of how the world works. And these are people who are fairly successful in life, you know. But as I think it was Upton Sinclair said, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it.
Well, yeah.
And we have our system I think, where a lot of people are running around doing nothing of any value, making money doing it. And that's why I think Buckminster Fuller said that, how you have too many people just doing worthless work, especially here in the United States. And they, you know, whether, you know, that's, you know, lawyers and bureaucrats and judges and officials and people servicing those industries. So we're living in a system of it's almost like we're living in a system of just one lie after another, just one deceit after another. And when you start investigating, looking into it, and, you know, pulling on those strings, and it starts to unravel on you. That's how I felt when I started. I have to talk to people about these things. And if I'm talking to them, I might as well record it and put it out on the internet and let other people listen to our conversation.
But what is the degree to which you think it might make a difference? Are you under any illusion that our society could be a whole lot better and be free of these lies? Or are you operating under some form of, this is just a small light that I can shine and a remnant of us can hold on to the truth before Jesus comes back?
Well, let me quote George H.W. Bush, 1,000 points of light.
No. Right, right.
I think the only hope that has is if you get so many people talking about it, you might have some impact, whether it's, if you're not reversing the course, you're delaying it somewhat. And much about life is delaying the inevitable, right?
Right. Well, now,
value to that. And it's not really given to us how these things turn out, other than the fact that if you are given some insight into what you think is the truth, I think you have an obligation to speak it. And I'm not saying I have a monopoly on the truth. That's why I say what you think is the truth, because my views of things change as I gather the evidence. So I'm always open to revision of my ideas of what's going on or my view of the world, you know. So you're
motivated not so much by whether or not it's going to change society, but just as a human being, you're committed to truth, and so you're going to tell the truth.
And you have to tell the truth. Don't know. I don't know how it works out. I don't know how it all turns out.
That's a good answer.
You know, I do know how, you know, I mean, it's like these people who are obsessed on the end times, or, you know, Armageddon, or the end of the world. So, well, the world's going to end for us individually, no matter what. I mean, we know that. I mean, we all die. So whether it's all at once or
many Armageddon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, so you're faced with the reality of mortality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or demise. And what are you going to do with your time on the planet? And most, you know, I can understand why people want to stick their head in the sand and just want to raise their family and not think about it. I run into that a lot. And that's the emotional, I think the emotional hurdle many people have. A lot of it is also pride. They don't want to, you know, talk to someone in their 50s and they have their worldview shattered. They want to admit that they're clueless about many things.
Right.
But, you know, and if you've, we've had, you know, we've had so many generations brought up on complete BS about history, about politics, and everyone gets excited about elections. But if you, when you look into things like MENA, Arkansas, drug running, human trafficking, sexual blackmail, the poisoning of the food, the destruction, you know, of our minds through education and toxic entertainment, it's hard to get too excited about a mere election.
Right.
You know, because we see those elections themselves are part of the mind control process. Going in and thinking, going in and voting makes a difference. To me, that's part of the trick, you know. But, you know, it's, you know, last time I voted was 2000, a presidential election. So,
well, how about that? Yeah, I think part of the solution is to be more proactive about where your information is coming from, and you know, whether it be, you know, an easy way to say it is turn off the TV and read a book, but
yeah.
I think today you can say don't just passively receive the information, whether it's, you know,
definitely
on the TV or just what kind of shows up on your news feed, but proactively find the places where you need to get that information and deliberately, you know, allow your mind to be informed in a strategic way. And,
yeah,
you know, I think that's a responsibility that we all have, and you can certainly make a scriptural argument for it. And I think that's one of the big keys, because if you just passively just allow it to just come to you, you're going to get a lot of lies.
Yeah, and the mass communication, entertainment, television, that's been it was weaponized long ago, and some say from the get-go, whether it's radio and the motion picture and the TVs. These things are the primary weapons that they control people. When I say mind control, you know, there's a sliding scale. But basically, by controlling movies and music and entertainment, these things kind of shape our worldview about what we expect out of life, what we think life is, and what's pleasant. And so, yeah, if you do something simple as just stop watching cable television or stop watching, you know, mainstream news, you neutralize one of their primary weapons. And with that free time, you can convert to more, mentally stimulating or constructive things like reading, which I think is by itself is just a better use of your brain. It develops the brain better than watching. It doesn't put you in a vegetative state like TV does. Then you can spark critical thought, and you know, and that's the key. And
it's certainly gotten worse with mass communication in the last century. But you know, if you read founding fathers like Jefferson, they say the same thing about newspapers.
Yeah, yeah. But at least back then, there were like broadsheets that were labeled partisan. You still have papers like something Democrat, the Republic. You know, they used to be partisan. But I think because people were more literal back then, although there was an element of propaganda to it, people, you had. In the colonial times, you had just under 3 million people in all the 13 states, and yet there are 300,000 copies sold of Common Sense. I mean, think about that. Imagine if you were to sell a book with that same amount of proportion to the population today. With 1% of the population, you had 300,000 copies sold. So that's the equivalent of what, 30 million copies sold in the United States today?
Yeah.
There was a time when people weren't as addicted to entertainment or amusement as they are today, because this wasn't there. This is why things like amusement parks were developed and movies were developed. This is why I think the techniques of Hollywood have been applied to the news, the special effects and manipulation to construct the news in ways that most people aren't willing to consider. Fake news, you know. So,
Bin Laden, the sequel.
Yeah, exactly. So that's something you have to. I had a discussion over the 4th of July weekend with some family members about that, and talking about they brought that the crazy theories about the no planes theories about 9/11. I said, well, going off point here. We're not talking about that. We were talking about Building 7, and I said, well, I said, why would people believe this media faker? I said, well, because there are some elements to the coverage of that day that do suggest some sort of manipulation or fakery. I don't know to what extent it goes, but there is some evidence of fakery. And I said, like most people, like the vast majority of the world, experienced 9/11 on the television through a studio. And studios have the capacity to manipulate what they're transmitting. And they have been caught doing that in the past. I brought out CNN's faking of the Scud missile attacks during the first Gulf War. That was, released, the raw footage was released a decade or so later, 15, 18 years later, when they're filming a Scud missile attack in the studios in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, you can watch it on the internet now. And so given that knowledge, why did you trust anything you see on the mainstream news as news? We get to the point now where I think much of what we see is news. We have no more reason to believe that it's has anything to do with the reality than the latest, B movie action thriller Hollywood produces. You know, I'm not saying everything is. I'm just saying we have reasons. Epistemologically justified in suspecting that what we're seeing isn't reality in many cases.
Yeah, one of the things that I'd like to get better at, and I wonder if it's because of the fluoride in the water or something, but You know, I think specific examples like you just named are really important. I think it's hard for people to get their minds around it. And, you know, if you can point out one specific example where the media just outright lied, it helps. Yeah. It helps to say, so it could have happened here, or, a place where, you know, the government, you know, just out and out lied to us, you know, and say, so it happened here specifically, so that could have happened on this one.
Yeah.
And a lot of times those specifics aren't right on the tip of my tongue. And I'd like to have like 5 or 10 good ones. Just, I came across a Zero Hedge article that Jay Dyer linked to a couple of days ago in one of his recent ones, but it's like a list of like 40 documented false flags over the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And those kind of things are very helpful. Mm-hmm.
And the mainstream news grew out of Office of War Information, OSS, during World War II. CBS, William Paley, Sarnoff, these are all OSS intel officers involved in psychological warfare.
That's interesting. So it wasn't Operation Mockingbird that came in after the fact and started to infiltrate them. They were.
Oh yeah, from the get go.
From the get go, yeah.
And even if you look, go back as the Orson Welles, the War of the Worlds broadcast was an experiment from the Radio Research Project. It was there to study the effects of mass communication and terror. And this is run up to the Second World War. This is getting people ready, you know, getting fearful of the enemy abroad. There were movies like, what was it, Shape of Things to Come, about preparing people for aerial bombardment in the early 30s. And, you know, this is part of predictive programming. It's also just part of just terror, spreading terror throughout the community to rule by fear. And that's what the news does today. It's all fear. It's all anxiety. It's that's why you should turn it off.
Yeah.
You know, these shooting incidents, all these things, they're just, you know, this the latest one down in Dallas is just odd. You know, we're supposed to believe the sniper reacted within a day, staked out a spot, and planned out a sniping to snipe this protest. You know, which these protests, Black Lives Matter, has been linked to George Soros, you know, and NGOs, which have been stirring up civil wars like in the Ukraine. And we all know that in the Ukraine, there were snipers sent in to shoot at the crowd, just to, not by the government, by the opposition.
Or maybe not by the – well,
who's
by,
paying?
By somebody.
Yeah, by somebody who's paying for this. And the same thing happened in the in Yugoslavia in the early 90s. You had these snipers being sent to gun people down. And remember Iraq when those SAS officers were caught shooting up the market? And Iraqis caught them. They were British agents. And the British went and broke them out of prison and didn't hear anything more about it. And this is what Blackwater does, right? Or Academy, whatever it's called now. And G4S, right? The guy who allegedly shot up this gay nightclub in Orlando, who's a part of G4S, which is a part of what used to be Wacken Hut, which has been linked to all types of dirty little things going abroad. Mercenaries going and shooting people up and, you know, stirring up wars abroad.
I got three buddies I have lunch with every week, and we talk about some of this stuff every now and then. Of course, I'm sort of the pushing the envelope, and they're trying to deal with my challenging views. But so Dallas came up this past Friday, and one of the guys is just deeply troubled by it all, and you know, he said, well, you know, they've got these, you know, five snipers, you know, that's pretty intense. And I said, well, I tell you what, I said, let's see how many of them are alive in a week from now.
Yeah.
So it turns out, didn't take but a couple of days, but four of them didn't actually exist. So it was only one, and he's dead.
Yeah, what's about this triangulated fire? I said, wait a second, I mean, that happened or not? Then all of a sudden you have a changing narrative, because you need at least three people to triangulate fire, from what I understand.
Yeah, that's the term.
Yes. Yeah. And then that changes. And they blow them up with a robot.
Yeah.
I mean, is this out of a movie? I mean, I think it might be.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, it's a tough way to go. I put a post on Facebook about 3 weeks ago about a month ago, questioning the Orlando shooting.
Yeah.
And boy, I just got a barrage of it went from calling me all sorts of names, but eventually I was a Holocaust denier because I was willing to ask questions about the veracity of 50 people dying at the Orlando gay disco.
Yeah, and then they had, you know, that type of rash, your lack of reason, you know, yeah. Well, that, you know, well, yeah, it was. I think the timeline has, 50 people being shot or 49 being shot dead in like 3 minutes or something?
Right.
And that's the official timeline. That's the police at 5, because it started at 2 a.m., then the shooting started at 5:17 to 5:20, and, you know, okay. And then, of course, you have this another case where the media goes through his apartment, you know. Same thing happened down in San Bernardino last year, if you recall, where the media rifles through the alleged shooter's apartment. This is a crime scene.
Okay. Yeah, I just think we live in a... I think we live in a country where most people don't really understand the whole concept of crime scenes and constitutional police authority to inspect things and just anything that has to do with kind of the rule of law and yeah. How crimes are dealt with and that sort of thing. It's just not, I don't think people are there anymore. I think they've watched so much TV and they've had so much public education that it's just not something they care about anymore.
Yeah. That's what some of the shootings and the high death tolls. I think people's idea of a movie, I think, Jay Dyer's talked about this with Chris and John over at Hoaxbusters about how people's experience in these shootings is a Schwarzenegger movie where every shot is a hit, you know, and so you can have these reported high death tolls and no one seems to question them, you know, or odd behavior or witnesses, you know, lack of blood, lack of any evidence, no ambulances. And again, I'm not there at these scenes, but it goes back to what I stated previously is I just don't trust what I watch on television. I think that's a sound position to take.
I think it's more than that. I think that they're more interested in the emotions than they are in the facts.
Well, that's the problem with the investigations. Whenever these occurrences or events go down, the media immediately focuses on the emotion of the event and its effect on society. And they don't ask any questions, look for evidence, hold officials accountable. They don't investigate.
Right.
So what good are they? They're just a PR for the government officials, you know.
And nobody's really cares about that either. They just want to get right to the show.
Yeah. And then it's an opportunity, what Patrick Henderson calls police state pageantry. And they always praise the first responders. And that's another thing, is you get this worship of the so-called first responder, you know, whether it's police, firemen, or I guess reserve, I don't know, military, whoever shows up first, I don't know. But there's no scrutiny of what goes. A good example is, let's say if there really were deaths down in Orlando, is how many were attributed to the response? That's a fair question, right? If they said they bulldozed one side of their building and went in shooting, well, it might be the 50 died because the SWAT team was had guns a-blazing. That's a fair question.
Yeah, but nobody's really interested in that question. They're interested in the narrative because it's an emotional narrative, and so that's kind of where it goes.
And becomes the whole thing is like almost like a promotional ad for gay rights. Yeah, because you have CNN and another PSYOP, another opportunity to, you know, there's different angles you can go with that. But it's, you know, again, it's just, it's a PSYOP. And that says all the, you know, and if you're keen to the signs of it, they're pretty easy to see. You know, I saw one video where a supposed victim was being carried and then off camera, they set him down and they both stretch like and smiling.
Yeah. That's the video I posted that I got shellacked on Facebook for.
So I mean, I guess they can criticize. I can look at that video and question it and you can yell at me for questioning it, but just answer the question. Is that normal to you? So, I don't know. Again, these events could be hybrid. They could be partially true. They could be all fake. I don't think they're true to the extent that they're being reported. So it's hard to say what type of operation it is. But I think it's easy to say that we're not being told the truth and we're being manipulated by it. So,
yeah, I mean, if when these things occur, which they seem to be happening more and more, the first thing I want to do first of all, I don't want to immediately sit there and watch tons of news reports on it. You know, I want to go to my sources and find out what people are saying, because I don't really want to be part of the PSYOP. I don't want to be part of the whatever the manipulated desire is.
Well,
yeah, and the other thing I want to do is I don't want to obsess over it.
Yeah,
because I want to choose what things in life I'm going to obsess over.
Yeah,
and just because the media has said that this event is the most important thing in the world for the next week, that doesn't make it the most important thing for me.
And it isn't. Already, you know, within 2 days, no one's talking about it anymore. Let's move on to something else.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I wrote a blog piece talking about you know, who sets the agenda for what we decide, what days are important, and, you know, anniversaries of 9/11, yada yada, and
yeah,
the kind of stuff. And I contrasted it with what I thought was what ought to be the agenda setter, which is the church calendar, the historic ancient church calendar. And so I've set the rhythm of my life to the church calendar. So I spent some time meditating on Pentecost about a month ago, and right now I'm looking at the Transfiguration. And in a few months, we'll do St. Nicholas and Christmas, and, you know, we'll go all over again, you know. But, you know, that's what's going to be the main agenda setter for me. And then I'll look at, you know, current news events and that kind of thing here and there and select which ones are important to me. But I'm not going to let, you know, a handful of atheists in New York tell me what's important.
Yeah. You know, why listen to them? There was an issue of fakery in the news. This isn't a big example. It just gives you an idea of what level that the news can be manipulated for whatever reason. Peter Lavenda, he's the author of Sinister Forces.
Yeah, don't know that one.
And he was giving a story, giving an account where he was in, I believe, Malaysia or Indonesia. I think it might be Indonesia. And he's watching CNN World at the bar that he's in. And CNN World is reporting on a riot occurring there in the city he's in. And in fact, just around the corner from where he is. Okay? And he goes out to look around. Nothing's going on. I mean, he can see what's going on. It's just normal. Nothing's going on. They're reporting a riot.
Oh, I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know,
now you can do a lot with manufactured news. If you want to short a government's, you know, like Indonesian bonds or stocks, and all of a sudden there's a report of political unrest in that country, in a few seconds, if you short enough bonds, you can make a heck of a lot of money. Now, intelligence agencies have been invested in the stock market. Okay, so this is another way that an intelligence agency or another criminal outfits or whoever who's in the know who gets a peek into this can make a lot of money by providing bad intelligence. And this was one of the problems with the intelligence agency from the get-go was one of the criticisms. I think the founder of the first director of Central Intelligence was Admiral Hillenkoetter, and he was run out because he was deemed incompetent. But the reason why he was deemed incompetent was he wasn't really big into operations, because he said it was a conflict of interest to have an agency provide intelligence and do operations, because pretty soon they'd manufacture the intelligence to justify the operations or do the operations to create the intelligence to achieve some ulterior, you know, objective, some secret objective of the CFR or something. But this is what you get what I'm getting at here is, if you can just report that something's happening somewhere, you can short stock markets and make a lot of money.
So yeah, I had a similar thought here. You know, I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and this is where we had the Chattanooga shootings.
Mm-hmm.
And It took place in a strip mall 4 minutes from my house.
Oh, okay. That was when the guys, the recruiting center?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I drive by it, you know, a couple times a week on my way to work when I go that way. But, you know, but I got to thinking about it the other day when I was driving by. There was no difference for it happening here in Chattanooga or it happening somewhere in, you know, Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it all takes place on the TV. I mean, I think there's a little monument there right now. And I think, you know, when it was happening, you know, some groups of people came by and, you know, prayed or, you know, did what they did. But there's really, because, and then it's even more distant than that and what we've already talked about, which was within probably minutes, the feds took over that case. Mm-hmm. And so everybody in Chattanooga, you know, reporters, you know, medical people, you know, coroners, investigators, they're out. It's all military and everybody is getting their press releases and their cues from the military and their information. So Chattanooga really didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah. And this, again, you know, all the local authorities are cut out. So everything's controlled. It's that closed loop that I talked about earlier. And so there's no scrutiny and all the information is controlled. And in that environment, you can have an event completely staged. I mean, it's practical. You can see it happening and they have the incentive to do it. If you doubt that, I know that people have suspicions regarding 9/11 and other events. We do know the 93 bomb in the World Trade Center was an FBI sting operation related to that. So we have that. In terms of early planning, we have the Operation Northwoods document, which was submitted to President Kennedy in 1962 by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was Lyman Lemitzer, and he proposed fake and real attacks in the United States, and I think centered mostly in southern Florida, to justify an invasion of Cuba and blame it on the Cubans, Cuban communist terrorists. And involved in that was, one was replacing a plane with a drone aircraft and shooting, having it shot down and blaming it on Cuban MiGs and claiming there were victims, students, American students on board that plane, dead. Presumably this would have required crisis actors, you know, like fake, whether in print or electronic media, there'd be fake stories planted of grieving families, right? I mean, so all that's in the planning. This is proposed to the president in 1962. Of course, Lyman Lemitzer, Kennedy that fired him or transferred him to NATO, where in a few years the Gladio would go live in Europe. These false flag attacks in Europe, which are now, you know, confirmed false flag attacks, where intelligence agencies working with the P2 Lodge, this Masonic Lodge in Italy, and other, you know, secret societies were staging false terrorist attacks throughout Europe and blaming it on, you know, Red Guard communists to create a strategy of tension to maintain cohesion in NATO. And that's right. That's known now. It's out there. It's no one really disputes this now. It was done. So why would we think that those same entities or agencies wouldn't plan similar attacks at home to achieve a similar political objective, whether it's a strategy of fear or, you know.
And Naomi Wolf points out this out in a video I've posted a few times, but three or four years ago, Congress passed a law that it's no longer illegal to do propaganda on the American people.
That's right. The Smith-Mundt Act or something they repealed, I think it was. You know, well, of course, that isn't to say prior to that the government was involved in propagandizing the American people, but the fact that they out and about get rid of the law.
But doesn't it seem like it's been ratcheted up since?
Yes,
then?
Yes, and that might be because it's one of these things where it's almost like that memo that Kenneth Starr wrote when he worked for William French Smith. As, you know, why would they bother doing this? Why, you know, because I guess they were ratcheting it up, and they guess some people within the agency thought they might face legal exposure if they're actually flying in cocaine directly from Central America into the United States, landing at an aircraft, you know, like places like Mena, Arkansas, where they might get caught. So they needed that protection because they're ramping it up. So I guess maybe this is an example where this might explain all these events that are going on now. Yes. people say, "Well, listen, if we're gonna start doing this on a weekly basis, we don't want to have face, you know, a legal penalty for this." So yeah, you got a point there. They've ratcheted it up. So there you go. You know, that's what it seems like. It's just almost like a weekly event where it's almost like, okay, another event.
Yeah, that's one way we can have hope, and is that at some point you get so desensitized. I mean, they have to keep increasing the number of people killed and increase the rate of shooting events. So at some point, won't the people just won't react anymore?
Well, a good sign is another good sign is that the world isn't as crazy as they want it to appear. That there aren't people out there who really want to go out and shoot up people and harm people. People that are doing this are being paid. And that's a relatively few amount of people. And so they have to, create these staged events in the hopes of riling the people up, So, again, it sounds crazy. As I said to you off call, we live in a crazy world. That's why it sounds crazy,
I hear you.
So anyway, anything you want to say before I let you go?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. I don't think we've plugged the book except the very beginning. It's called Hillary Invents, A Story of Love, Death, and Cover-Up.
Where is it available?
Amazon. Just type Hillary Invents in the Amazon search engine, and just remember Hillary has two L's.
Okay. And you have a website?
Bluebridge.com, B-L-O-O, bridge.com. I write about other things too. I've got some articles on there that I do. I write several things about Eastern Orthodox Christianity. That's kind of my gig. I grew up with a fundamentalist pastor, but I became Eastern Orthodox about 15 years ago.
Yeah, I saw your piece on Soul of the East about monarchy.
Yeah, I wrote a piece about looking at monarchy and democracy from a biblical perspective, and that got some chatter. So yeah.
Yeah, I added a comment there that said, even from a libertarian standpoint, the Christian monarchies of yesteryear were more fiscally disciplined and respectful of individual rights than today's Masonic democracies, just by the numbers, if you look at it.
No, I saw that, and it made a good point. What's the guy's name? Is it Hoppe?
Hans Hermanns Hoppe. He's a libertarian. He wrote a book called Democracy, the Goddess That Failed. And he makes a very good argument behind democracy. He basically says that in a monarchy, you have a chance of getting a good leader. In a democracy, you don't have a chance of getting a good leader.
Yeah, exactly.
But he pointed out the fact that under monarchies, the government expenditure never exceeded 10% of GDP. That was like in Russia, which was the authoritarian, autocratic state. Whereas in the West, under the Christian monarchies, you had usually in peacetime was anywhere from 1% and 3%. And they all respected the gold standard. So there is enough. So really, from a libertarian standpoint, he makes the point that monarchies make more sense than democracy.
Yeah, well, that article I just started by saying things are so insane now. I mean, we've got Satan being worshipped at the Olympics ceremony, and
yeah.
We've got gay marriage and transgender bathrooms, and it's just gotten so nutty now that we really got to think outside the box. And I think we've got to turn over every single rock, and monarchy's one of them. So that's kind of how I started that article.
Well, and of course the Illuminati, the New World Order, whatever you want to call it, I think their objective was the destruction of throne and altar. I think back in 1776 when they started.
Yeah, they're doing pretty good.
They're pretty good. So, and of course they sell this they use the language of freedom, which is an old trick, right? So,
yeah, but to try to get positive, I am Eastern Orthodox, and Russia is a big stronghold for that. And, the boomerang effect of in Russia is pretty encouraging. I mean, they saw the worst of the worst. It got as liberal and godless and murderous as it possibly could there, and they came back to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a revival in Russia. We've seen 25,000 churches built, and we've seen people are turning back to the church. They teach Christianity 101 in the public schools there. It's just a movement back towards God, and so that's pretty encouraging. So that's one of the things in the midst of a lot of craziness that we can be positive and hopeful about.
And one thing you got to remember that godless Bolshevism was a Western import.
It sure was the Western bankers from New York.
That and Coca-Cola and blue jeans. So.
Be careful, Chattanooga's a.
I know.
That's where Coca-Cola bottling started here. I wrote a book about it.
I know. That's why I said that. You heard that
tread light. Oh, okay. Tread light.
But back then they used pure cane sugar, right?
I've actually used cocaine too.
There you go. That's right. Coca-Cola. So, well, listen, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me tonight. It was a great talk. I know we wandered a bit, but I thought we would, given the nature of the discussion, the subject.
I like hearing you wander. You're like Jay. You got a near photographic memory. You remember all these things, man. And you're able to tie them together.
That's quite a compliment. Thank you. Enjoyed your book. I do. I did. It's a fun read, a very quick read, and for me it was a refresher course because I just remember all that was going down, and I do like the road you take with it, because it does. I think it is a microcosm into how some of these bigger scandals are handled and the cover-ups, and gives you an idea of how these things are so easily controlled and why the American people are so easily deceived in these things. So right. I highly recommend it. It's a quick read. It's worth your time, and it's a cheap read. So it's, you know, buying it won't send you to the poorhouse. It's worth your time and money. So
appreciate that.
It's a good work. Well, Dean, thanks a lot for being here tonight, and we'll talk again soon, maybe. I'll follow you at Soul of the East, and maybe one of these days, if you want to expand your thoughts on monarchy versus democracy, and if you can read that book, I don't know if you've, you know, Goddess, Democracy, the Goddess That Failed, you might enjoy that book, so I highly recommend it. Maybe we can have a discussion about that.
Could be good. Yeah, you can take a look at my Blue Bridge site and some of that stuff on Orthodoxy. You might find interesting as a podcast too. I don't know how much religion you do, but that's a area where I have some content to deliver.
Yeah, take a look at that. Yeah, I know Jay does that stuff too. He's into the I guess Eastern Orthodox or
right. Yeah, Eastern. Exactly.
And there's a lot of interesting thought there at Soul of the East because of what's happened in the West, particularly the Roman Catholic Church, and some of the, I think might be the Masonic influences that have infiltrated the church and created a lot of problems in the West. So anyway, thank
all
you.
Right.
And good night, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Tim.
Take care. Bye-bye.